Recently, some of the leading minds of industry gathered to talk about the future possibilities that drive them. Recorded live in Sydney at GE's Decoding Industry event, I, Adam Spencer, was lucky enough to have a conversation about the digital industrial playbook with one of the big hitters in the world, Jeff Immelt, the global chairman and CEO of GE. In this wide-ranging discussion, we touched on the need for constant reinvention, the effects of globalization, and how to respond to digital industrial transformation. Here's the highlights of that conversation. You know you're here in Australia, you've said how much you love this country, but nothing is more Australian than out there a little while ago in the sight of the Harbour Bridge and the Opera House, people having a glass of wine at 11:30 a.m. because it's the start of lunch. That is Australia, my friend.
People like to have fun here, it's great.
We found out chatting beforehand, you and I actually going way back, are both maths nerds from a lifetime ago. Talk us through your mathematical background.
Oh look, I was always a kid that liked math. And when I went to college, I continued that pursuit. And I happened to go at a time period and to a school that had this amazing math department. And all the professors came from Eastern Europe, you know, kind of after World War II. And they were just awesome teachers. And, you know, you said you learned how to program in Fortran. I actually learned how to program in BASIC. So I can actually go one generation before you. But, you know, look, I got a math degree, math and physics degree, and then an MBA. I use my math degree every day. I never use my MBA so much. You know, the people around me do. The things I learned in business school, the people around me do. The things I learned in getting a math degree, I still use those every day. So I don't know what that says about either one, but study math. Math is in.
Let's start with some percentages. Dom told us earlier that when you look at the Fortune 500 in 2000, 50% of those companies are now gone. The stat that's often used is of the original Fortune 500 in 1955, 60 years later in 2015, only 11% of those companies survived. I think you guys are the oldest surviving company from the original Dow Jones.
Yeah.
How does something so large survive so long in such a volatile environment?
Well, look, I mean, I think it's a little bit our structure. So, you know, the original context that Edison had for the company wasn't that it would be a single purpose company. It was that it would be a multi-business company. And I think one of the advantages of being a multi-business company is the fact that you never have to be tomorrow the same you are today. So one part of our culture always is that you don't let other people define you. You kind of sit there and say, we can change. We can do new things. We can get into new businesses. The other piece I would say, Adam, is just a long-standing focus on people and on learning. You know, the sense that we're never the best, we can always get better. And I think those two things are what resiliency and longevity are really ultimately all about. For Google, who's an amazing company, I'm so impressed, but for them to be the same age as GE, we would have to be in the year 2150, right? So think about what you all be doing at that time. So it's this constant stream of, I'd say, renewal, trying new things, resiliency, focus on people, and a focus on learning, a focus on getting better.
When you talk about, you know, imagine Google being that age, because, you know, they said back at the time of the original Fortune 500, the average life expectancy of a company was 75 years. Now, depending how you cut it, it might be as little as 10 years. How far can you realistically look ahead and have any sort of real feel as to what the structure of GE or where you're going to be? What's the sort of time frame that you consider looking a long way ahead now?
So, I would answer that in two ways. I think you have to run a company with a point of view, right? And it doesn't mean that you have to do 10 or 15 year forecasts, but you have to have a point of view. You know, the point of view that we have around GE is one that we want to be, you know, kind of technically based. We believe that's a core competency. We believe that globalization is a core competency. We think that proximity to customers is a core competency. And so we run the company making long-term bets as it pertains to China or Europe or things like that, that are consistent with our belief of what we're good at and where the world is going, right? So I would say you have to make yourself resilient for the changes in the short term, but have a real point of view of the directions that you want to take the company. You know, I've done this job for 15 years. We've really done five things. We've refocused the portfolio. We've reinvested in technology. We've massively globalized the company. We've transformed to be a more digitized company. And we've simplified the way we run the place, really. More decentralized and things like that. Really five things in 15 years. So we don't get up every year and have a new theme, a new strategy. We stick to things over the long term. Now, the other thing I'd say is, look, if you're in the aviation business, if you're going to be serving Alan Joyce for the long term or Qantas for the long term, we've got to be making investments today, for instance, in terms of electrifying jet engines, electrifying flight. And that may not see the light of day for 20 years. You know, in some of our industries, 20 years is a moment in time, right? So we have to be making some of these long-term bets even through, I would say, periods of uncertainty. We like doing things that not very many people can do, right? We like being in industries and technologies that require scale and staying power and things like that. But, you know, at the same time, you have to be ready for Brexit. You have to be ready for elections in the U.S. Mm. You have to be ready that oil prices go from 150 to 50. And so you have to have a resilient core that can, let's say, keep ballast when the world's going like this, even while you're executing a long-term strategy and a long-term plan.
Can I ask you about, you said you refocused the portfolio. I read it once described also as a radical restructuring. I mean, it was, for people outside of GE, they might not appreciate how much change happened in that time. Can you walk people through that
sort
of period of change? And I'd love to know from you, when did you first think or realize, yes, we have to do this? Because it was something very big to commit to.
Yeah, so I would say if I were to come to Australia, let's say in the early 2000s, I would be talking about is financial services. The only GE presence in Australia 10 or 15 years ago was GE Capital. Now we have no GE Capital. And we have an oil and gas business, a healthcare business, and things like that. So I think, you know, this is quite natural in GE, is that, you know, I'm a lifetime GE person, but I had a very different vision for the company than my predecessor had. I had a vision for GE that was more technically based, that was more global, that was closer to the customer. You know, my predecessor was a great leader. He wanted a broader portfolio. He was a big believer in media and financial services. He believed in the efficacy of the general manager, let's say, that any manager could manage anything. I never believed that. I actually thought you had to know things to be a good manager, right? You had to have real deep expertise. Mm-hmm. And particularly, you know, it's one of the things I've learned over my tenure is never confuse tailwind for good management, you know? Like when oil's $150 a barrel, right? Everybody's smart. when iron ore is $130, you know, everybody's a genius. Everybody's smart. Hmm. It's not until oil hits 40 that you see who the good people really are, right? So I felt like the company was not positioned for the world we were going to face. And then really, you know, we started at them kind of piece by piece, one piece in, one piece out. You know, the financial crisis really accelerated everything, but we kind of had a vision for, you know, we sold insurance, we sold a bunch of financial services, we doubled down on life sciences, we started building out oil and gas, not because we wanted to time oil prices. We felt like the industry was under-competed from a technology standpoint. We took the company to China and things like that. So piece by piece, with the global financial crisis kind of as a recess to really accelerate, you know, things as things are going on. And we're probably the only leadership team in history that's bought $100 billion worth of businesses and sold $100 billion worth of businesses, which I don't advise really necessarily. But it actually is quite unique, I would say, in terms of a repositioning of a really big company.
It's not only within GE that's known. It did seep into pop culture through our the TV show 30 Rock, and there was that great scene where Alec Baldwin said to Tina Fey, you know, They're selling NBC to a company called Cabletown, and that's Cabletown with a K, damn it. And when I told my older daughter what I was doing for the course of the week, and I said, oh, that's, I'm doing this, and it's really interesting. I'm talking to the man who's in charge of GE. Do you remember 30 Rock? Because we used to watch 30 Rock all the time, and she loved it. And I said, it's like I'm interviewing the real Jack Donaghy. She wanted me to say to you, you were her favourite character in the show. Yeah. She loved it, and she's really impressive. Did you guys... fascinating pop culture reference.
In 2005, we owned NBC, and one of the people in the arc of my career that I have the most respect for, who's just an amazing leader, a genius, is a guy named Lorne Michaels. Hmm. And Lorne was the originator of Saturday Night Live, for those of you who don't know. An amazing guy, 40-year run on a TV show, and he was the producer of 30 Rock. And the NBC management wasn't going to pick up the TV show. So Lorne came to see me and, you know, went over their head and said, look, I hate to do this, but look, I've been associated with the network for a long time. You know, I've never done this before, but, you know, I've made a TV show. I've done so much for you guys, and you guys are just treating me so terribly and not picking up the TV show. And I said, well, tell me what the TV show is about. And he says, well, you know, it's kind of a... It's about a TV show, and it's about a network and things like that. And he said, I guarantee you that if you pick up this show, GE will always be proud. And so I rolled the bosses. We put the TV show on. I turn it on the first time, and my character is like describing his private parts in a like the very first episode. And then every episode since then turned out to be a runaway hit. And all it did was dump on GE every episode. So, when it finally went into syndication, I said to Lauren, look, Lauren, amazing TV show. I wasn't proud of every episode, though, I have to say. But he was a great guy. And it was, you know, things are only funny because they're true, you know. So I think everybody, when you watch shows like The Office or 30 Rock, you see enough truth that you sit back and say, God, do I look that bad? Do I really, you know, so it's...
Well,
it's
the show did occasionally name check Jack Welch.
Yeah, exactly.
And he even made a little cameo in one of them.
Yeah.
Did Alec Baldwin ever follow you around for the day, just picking up method acting mannerisms?
Yeah, so I did. I spent some time with Alec, and we did a little bit of that, but I always said, I ain't ever going to be on the show, okay? Because, like, I actually have a job to do, you know, and I don't want to be mistaken for you, but, you know, quite honestly. So, but it was a great hit.
This might be a naive outsider's question, but when something as significant as that restructuring runs its course and now you have the new shape, does that free up a part of your mind to concentrate on the next massive thing?
You know, what I would say is the people will never understand how hard it is to reshape a company and run a company at the same time. You know, in other words, you know, private equity guys, they buy and sell companies. And that's got its own arc, but you don't really have to worry about anything outside of 4 or 5 years. You buy something, you cure it, you sell it. You know, so what we were doing is we were kind of reshaping the company and meanwhile reinvesting in technology, trying to get people to a safe place, communicate to investors as you're going through it. And the liberation of just having what I would call portfolio stability, it just allows leaders to kind of do more things, use their minds in different ways and things like that. And I think that is a awesome way to kind of have the company. Now, while we were doing all this, we've been investing a lot in R&D. And I would say we made a lot of our big digital investments, you know, 6 or 7 years ago, even while we were in financial services, with the knowledge that these would be the investments that kind of carried us forward.
Another thing that has changed a bit is the concept of leadership and the role of leadership. I saw you nodding when Dom was saying that the person at the top is often worse placed to make a decision that's floating around. You say how there used to be a structure of the head office as a temple for review.
Mm-hmm.
And now you say you've got to have a world of ideas where you remain contemporary, remain paranoid. Dom spoke about the spreadsheet, the old spreadsheet model, person at a mahogany desk, everyone in their cells. Can you talk to us a little bit about that?
Yeah, look, I think most companies are overmanaged. I would wager to say everybody in this room is probably overmanaged, because we think it's about methods too much. So I resonate with, you know, we don't want to be crazy. We don't want to be poorly managed. But if you're like the seventh person that signs a lease or something like that, you have a bad job, you know? you should go find something else. You should know your future stinks. So I think we come from an era of professional management. And now new companies like Amazon or Apple, they're just breaking down this kind of old role of what is professional management. So one of the hardest things I ever had to do, I used to sit in front of a room like this in GE, and I would say, I want you to do more with less, right? How many of you have given that speech? I want you to do more with less. Now what I say is, I want you to do less. Turns out people don't want to do less, right? You'd think it would be liberating, but it's like, I tried that for like a year, and then I finally said, okay, now I have to undo things, because you don't want to do less. You insist on reviewing everything and things like that. So I think modern companies need to have less management, right? Leaner management. You need to make sure, one of the things the earlier speaker talked about was, in simple terms, you want to link, kind of the values to how people get paid, to how they get evaluated. That's important. You need to make speed an imperative. And then the last thing that I think big companies can learn from small companies is just the need for transparency. The need that everybody in the company gets to see the same data, that it's openly shared. The difference between a manager and a subordinate is that the manager knows one more fact than the subordinate, and therein lies the power. You really need to have broadly open data and broadly open transparency, right? So I think, I forget the name of the company now, but I was quite impressed with the guy. They trivialize the following fact, is that, companies like Qantas or GE or South32, we have a legacy enterprise. Hmm. So you just don't get up one day and say, okay, I'm not going to take care of the 300,000 people that kind of like worked with yesterday. I'm just going to go to the new. And the trick for a lot of us in this room is you've got to not be burdened by the legacy, but you have to find a way to bring them with you as you go on this journey. Well, and that's possible, by the way. It's not easy, but it's possible. You can't slow down. You have to be willing to try new business models while you're trying new technology, but that is absolutely key.
Well, that's amazing. When you say the 300,000 plus employees, I mean, when you launched Global New Directions, you looked at your senior professional band,
yep,
which is 25,000,
yep,
people, which is staggering itself. 25% were on board with change, 25% not on board, 50% were just sitting there and not really connected to it. So can you talk us through that idea of the global new directions and trying to, I've got a quote here from Jeff about harnessing the power. Young employees have an unconstrained view of the future and the most to lose from the status quo. That's a powerful dynamic. If you give them a voice, they can be constructive agitators for change. That's what Jeff had to say.
So my friend right here, who's the robotics startup,
Marita Cheng, RoboGals.
So I would have 25 or 30 people her age, and I would get together with them, monthly, every other month, and things like that. And it was a way to just break through, what are people actually seeing? What's their day-to-day life like? What tools do they use? How do they feel about the company? What are they willing to risk? What are they willing to do? And I think particularly in big companies, you need to give voice in a number of different ways. And that's another way that you can break through. I think one of the things that I always laugh at, or not laugh's too cruel, I observe in politics, which is people think, and I spend a lot of time in the U.S., so I would make this not about Australia, but about U.S., because I'm sure Australia politicians are much better. a politician in the U.S. thinks they give a speech, and that moves people to action. A speech means nothing, really. In GE, everybody works for me. I pay their salaries, really. In some ways, I have a lot more control over their life than a politician does. But I'm selling our ideas every day to every employee. I'm doing town halls and webcasts and, selling the mission and selling the ideas and selling the direction and things like that over and over and over and over and over again. And people can watch the words and the actions and see things like that. So I think one of the points I would make is just how ongoing the role of leadership is and how you have to sell your ideas every day and how you have to take that seriously, and then how the actions have to go with it. I listen to what people say still maybe with a little bit more cynical mindset than I did when I was younger, but I always watch what they do. I always watch what people do. Actions speak so much louder than words. So good leaders have to be very repetitive and diligent about communication, and then have very clear actions in terms of what, you know, we want to be digital industrial, we want to do additive manufacturing. Last year we spent $6 billion on those two things. When you spend that much money, people sit back and say, hey, I guess it's not BS, right? I guess this is really serious about where the company is going.
We'll talk about politics in a couple of seconds. Can I ask you a one-off question for someone in your position? I'm always fascinated to ask people who have very senior roles that by definition, if a decision comes to you to be made, it's not an 80-20 call. It wouldn't get to you unless it's like 60-40, 55-45. How do you make big decisions? You know, game-changing decisions where there's going to be a clear winner, clear loser, or big stakes, or what you know is a really big or tight call. What's the secret to doing the best you can to get those right?
I think you have to have people around you, first and foremost, who tell you the truth and who you trust. And so I think you need a culture where bad news travels at the same pace as good news travels. And you have to have people who, when they say things, you know what they mean. They're not shading the words. You really have a sense for who they are. And then, you know, Adam, one of the things I've always liked to do is just, I like to ruminate on things. I like to dwell on them. I like to wallow. I like to kind of just like chew on it. And then, when you go, you go. And when you go, you get people to stand in line, you know, stay in line. And to your point, basically when you're CEO, at least in my case, you're making decisions around nothing fun anymore. You know, really what you are is you're like captain of the crap patrol, you know? So all the basic fun things, they happen, you know, the teams take care of those, right? And you get like the nuclear waste of decisions. And that's the way it should be, by the way. You know, the way it should be is, you know, by the time it gets to me, it's disproportionate risk reward, right? You've got a lot of downside, you got a little bit of upside, you got to be thinking through what it is. And I've just never really been burdened by making a decision. The day I became COG, I said to the team, you're going to question my decisions, but you're never going to question my intentions. And 15 years later, I think the people in GE would say, yeah, we've questioned some of his decisions. You know, some of them may not have worked out well, but we haven't questioned why the decision was made. What was the right context? Did you put the company first? And I don't think people in a company, they don't expect perfection. You know, they expect accountability, you know. They expect somebody to be thoughtful, accountable, and in the end, I think that's what the trade is. Yeah,
I think you have.
But I like to wallow. I like to think and ruminate, and I just am like you just go through that process. Yeah,
I think you've invented a new member of the C-suite, the CCP, the captain of the crap patrol.
Yeah,
that is
just
fantastic. Yeah. Tell us quickly about industrial internet. To some people in the room, a term they've been familiar with for a long time. For others, they're just stumbling upon. GE's pretty much coined the phrase. What do you mean when you say industrial internet? Jeff said possibly the greatest revolution of all. Alan Joy said how big a change this is. Industrial internet.
So you basically have, you've had three waves of the internet. You've had kind of the consumer internet as defined by Amazon, Google, people like that. You've had the enterprise internet as really defined by Microsoft and Salesforce.com. And the industrial internet is kind of the third wave, and it's defined by the combination of analytics with physics of products for the purpose of making, you know, kind of better decisions around predicting failure, better safety, better quality. And it's all about industrial productivity, right? This is the operations technology that goes into every factory. And one of the elements of the industrial internet is what I call the power of one, 1%. So if you can improve the output of an LNG train by 1%, that's worth $200 million, right? Alan talked about 1% improval of the fuel efficiency. If you do 1% efficiency of the entire GE installed base, that's $3 billion, right? So there's going to be, around the industrial internet, there's going to be, let's say, a cloud-based platform, kind of like Salesforce.com and CRM and things like that. There's going to be an apps nation galore. There's going to be a ton of investment in edge devices like robotics, AI, controls, drones. So think about edge to cloud. Think about edge as the machine to cloud. There's going to be a whole ecosystem of $100 or $200 billion that goes into the industrial internet. So it's a, what makes it unique is that both the enterprise and the consumer internet have been basically horizontal platforms. The industrial internet is going to be a combination of horizontal and vertical. You have to know healthcare. You have to know oil and gas. You have to know the deep domain space. You have to have a brain plus a body, right? You don't care. If you and I buy the same books and Amazon shares the data, you don't care. If Shell and Chevron have a gas field, Shell cares about what Chevron knows and doesn't know, right? They have very unique use cases. So you're going to conquer the industrial internet one customer at a time, and it makes it very different. But it's going to impact all our businesses. It's a huge opportunity. It's going to redefine productivity. When we started 7 years ago, Adam, we didn't really know what we were doing. We were just kind of experimenting. Now what I would tell everybody definitively, hand on a Bible, based on 35 years of business experience, this is a great idea. It's a huge idea. Now the question I have for us is, are we good enough to do it, right? The question is no longer, is this going to be a big industry? The question I have for me and us is GE going to be good enough to do it? But somebody's going to do it. Somebody's going to launch the kind of systems I talked about.
You said at the top of the day that you see a role for larger organizations when people have looked at this space and thought it's all startup. Now, obviously, startups are not unimportant. Where do they fit in? How do you harness their capacity? And with something like the partnership, I think, announced yesterday with South 32, which is sort of a spin-off project, how does that all come together? How do startups fit into that ecosystem? How do you harness what they've got?
I think there's going to be a big app ecosystem that startups are going to be a big part of. There's going to be lots of nascent technology around sensors, controls, robotics that startups are going to be a part of. But what makes the industrial internet a little bit different is a little bit's technology and a little bit is business model. And for the industrial internet to work, you have to go risk on. So basically, the way it works is you go to Qantas and say, I'm going to guarantee 99% time on wing, and if I don't achieve it, it's on my nickel. And if I do achieve it, I get upside. Big industrial customers aren't going to trust startups on that risk on trade, right? It's just not going to happen. And not that I don't have anything, but a startup that's part of an offering that's given by a bigger company or an enterprise player, that can move the needle. When Amazon started, what made Amazon amazing was a little bit the interface was really cool, but the business model was amazing, right? And so a lot of the internet has to do with how do you match the technology with the business model. And in the industrial internet, what you really have to think about is who's going to take the risk on trade based on knowing more about the data, knowing more about the product than other people in the industry have. That's the business model change.
With Amazon, and I know you have tremendous respect for the model and for Jeff's work, some people are wary of the Amazon ization, which is a clunky word I've just invented, I won't use again. But the idea of one organization becoming so large, so powerful, across such a broad suite of products, that scares some people. Are there valid concerns for people to have as we move into this age if a few digital industrial behemoths control so much stuff?
It's a great question. It's an amazing question because the answer is, it's tough being big when every citizen of the world hates big, right? And to a certain extent, the startup world, people in the valley, they've been able to fly under the, you know, we've been big for a long time. We've been a target for a long time. And one of the things you learn when you run a company like GE is this word I call context, right? And the way I define context is, you know, I not only have to understand what GE does, but I have to understand how GE fits with the world, You guys get that? You know, that's what, when I say context, these big tech companies, they haven't had to worry about context, right? They've had a free ride because we were the ones getting criticized. Now they're right in the middle, right? They're right in the crosshairs, whether it's on diversity, whether it's on how much data they have, whether it's the fact that the U.S. government wants them to share data, they don't want to share it. And they're going to have to learn how to justify their right to be big. You know, GE, we have to justify our right to exist, both with investors and also with society. Jeff and Amazon, who's been amazing, they're going to have to figure out a way to make their scope fit in a world where they're now huge. And, you know, if anybody can do it, I think he can. But, you know, look, I look forward to them now being the target, and we can just be the little guy hiding in the weeds, you know, and they can be the ones, you know, trailblazing as it pertains to government relations and activists and things like that. And, you know, we've learned that. We've learned how to deal in that world.
It's interesting you talk about government. Obviously, something as significant as GE and someone in your position, you come into the orbit of the federal government. You led Obama's Jobs Council. I read a great story where you broke the news to your mum and dad that you'd been asked to take up that position. Can you recount that?
So I'm center right. So I was like a moderate Republican. I am a moderate Republican. There's like 12 of us in the U.S. that have that political view. There's, I think, maybe 12 of us left, right? But my parents are quite conservative. My mom and dad are extremely conservative. I grew up in Cincinnati, Ohio, which is a very conservative town. So President Obama asked me in 2011 to lead his Council on Jobs and Competitiveness, a pretty high-profile role at the time. So I called home, and my mother answered the phone. I said, "You're going to see me on TV tomorrow with President Obama. He's asked me to lead his Jobs Council." And my mom, without even hesitating, said, "Well, you said no, of course, didn't you?" And I said, "Well, you know, Mom..." She was a teacher. I said, "You were a civics teacher, you know, you're supposed to serve your country," things like that. But that's as close to politics as I wanted to get.
But yeah. you would have known the current president.
I do, yeah.
He fronted a TV show for what was your then network.
Yep.
So when you started to see him firming as a genuine chance to win the Republican nomination, what were your thoughts? And I'm not asking for comments on him as an individual, but
to watch that phenomenon. Look, I think everybody was. I think everybody was surprised. I mean, really, to go from having the day he announced, he had 0% in the polls. So in June of 2015, when President Trump announced to be president, he had no standing in the polls. To 18 months later, becoming the president of the United States, that has no precedent in my lifetime, really. There's never been a businessman in the White House that I can remember, right? So you know, we're in new, uncertain times. And so I think you have to sit back and say, gosh, everybody was surprised by, you know, kind of that path that he was able to go. And he, you know, he did a show called The Apprentice, and, you know, my own personal interactions with him, both as an investor and when we owned the media business, were all quite positive. He was a good guy to work with, yeah.
You mentioned he and globalization and Brexit, and some people say that it represents a new sort of push to protectionism and isolationism. Some people say that globalization is a force you just cannot fight against, there's no point. At times, GE's being questioned about its global role. You get some heat inside America sometimes for jobs overseas. You talk about that percentage change, technology overseas. Give us your thoughts on, is this just a minor hiccup and it's all going in one direction with globalization, or could things genuinely change?
You know, again, a great question. I'm going to maybe give a little bit more of a U.S. context, or maybe you know, global context, because I think in Australia you might see globalization a little bit differently. So I said earlier, in one generation of GE, I've seen our company go from 80% in the U.S. to 70% outside the United States, right? When I first started doing globalization in the GE world, in the 1980s, it was closing factories in the U.S., moving them to Mexico for the purposes of doing what I call wage arbitrage, right? And that's what a lot of companies did back in those days. Now, We don't do that today. You know, when we globalize, it's to sell more things in China. It's to sell more things in Australia. It's to sell more things in India. We're a $22 billion exporter from the U.S., and we import $6 billion a year. So we are a big net exporter from the U.S., and we're winning around the world because we invest in local teams and things like that. So the first point I'd make is people confuse outsourcing with globalization. You know, we have 23,000 employees in China, GE, all Chinese. And they're because we sell MR scanners and jet engines and gas turbines. And we have higher market share in China than we do in the U.S. That's globalization. That's hard work. That's what we do. That's okay. Now, people hate globalization, okay? They hate it because they still think it's all outsourcing. They hate it because they blame it for wage stagnation. There's 100 different things. I understand that. I think people too often, they confuse technology and globalization. But we have to understand that this nationalist trend didn't start in the U.S., is not unique to the U.S., but it exists in China, it exists in India, it exists probably here, it exists in Europe, and the pendulum is going from just pure globalist to being, I'd say, more protectionist, and we're still moving that way. So what does that mean for a company like us? Because we still view our ability to sell around the world, this is a very top priority for us. And so what we've chosen to do is we're extremely local. We have an Australian face, we have a Brazilian face, we have a German face, and we have really localized our contact, we have localized our footprint, we've localized our factories, and we have the ability to be an extremely local player, and I think that's the winning play. I think if you're waiting for trade deals or TPP or things like that, that's not coming. And what we really, the path we've chosen is to be, you know, a local player in every market that we serve. And that's serving us well. We're in an odd spot politically. There is more nationalism, but it doesn't take away our desire to be a global company. But we're not going to do it. We're not going to need our country's help. We're going to have to do it on our own. You know, we used to start a global trip in Washington, D.C. and ask for the U.S. ambassador to Australia to help us do more things in Australia. We're on our own, you know. We need to do our own work. And I think that's okay. You know, a lot of the global institutions like WTO or IMF or things like that, they're 70 years old. The odds of them still being contemporary today the way they were 70 years ago is zero. So we have to take control of our own destiny, and that's okay. I don't mind that. In a more protectionist world, I think we can differentiate ourselves even better.
Let me run you through a couple of topic areas we've touched on today. A very germane Australian topic, energy.
Yeah.
Fascinating Australia because we're at the crossroads. We are blessed with sun and wind. The tides off the coast of Australia could power vast parts of the world. At the same time, we are so deeply embedded in the traditional fossil fuel industry. When you look at Australia in terms of energy, what do you think? We in Australia find it a very complicated topic.
Look, I've seen this happen before. I've seen a number of countries to get to where Australia's gotten today, where you've kind of perverted markets with subsidies, you've unclear rules, people don't know what to invest in. You know, when you have a surplus of power and curtailments and your pricing's doubled, that's a bad trio. You know, those are three bad facts when they happen all in sequence. So I think, you know, Adam, the only way out of it is you need to unwind the market mechanisms you put in place. You've got to have more transparency around rules, and you've just got to let different technologies find their place, not because they're what the government picks, but because they're what makes economic sense. And you know, energy is always about this combination of pollution reduction, global warming, cost of electricity, and job creation. And those three things have to intersect. Now, in Europe, they're gonna pay a lot more for electricity. They don't care how much they pay for electricity because they believe in global warming and they want cleanliness. The U.S. is different. I don't know where Australia is on that spectrum. But those three things are really going to be important. And it just seems like the government kind of has itself wrapped around the axle right now. So I pick up the newspaper the last 2 days, and you see a more coal story, and you see an anti-coal story, right? And they're competing ideas, and we're having a war on the future of coal industry in Australia about 100-year-old technology. And that just seems to be a challenging place. So transparency, I think you gotta stick with the 2020 plan, because that has deep ramifications, and you've gotta have a bigger solution set that people know what to invest in. And you gotta do those things, I think, all at the same time. There's other countries that have been in the same place Australia is right now.
Healthcare, current Australian of the Year points out that we live in this age when we can do phenomenal things. We can design machines, and our ability to suck out data and understand genetics are incredible. At the same time, so costly to produce the best of the best in that field. Some people are worried that healthcare is leading us down this road where it will just suck up every dollar for every government budget to produce amazing results, but something that's unsustainable. What are your insights into getting healthcare right?
Look, I think healthcare is really complicated country by country. In the U.S., we're heading towards 20% of the GDP of the U.S. I think it's likely going to hit there. It's likely going to stay there, I would say. The new innovation is amazing in terms of what it will do. And you like math. I think healthcare is like a big linear programming model where you've got more or less five things you have to do at the same time. You've got to turn healthcare more into a consumer entity. There's just no doubt unless you have more input, more knowledge of healthcare, you're not going to get there. We've got to do a better job of treating chronic disease. That is by far and away the biggest spender in the healthcare market. We've got to drive better low-cost systems, both from a regulatory standpoint and an efficiency standpoint. We've got to align incentives with care and outcomes. We've got to have better quality metrics. And all those things have to happen at more or less the same time. You know, in the U.S., we're really at a stalemate in healthcare. So I'm not sure we can brag about our system. My observation in Australia is they have quite good practitioners here. Actually, healthcare could be a big Australian industry if you really treated it like that. You know, this is going to be a place where I think if you had the right regulatory regimes, you've got better universities, you've got better practitioners here, you could develop a real industry in Australia for the long term. But I think, Adam, politicians would be, you know, we're in this room, and the young people more than the old people, you're going to be working on healthcare for the rest of your life. Mm. You're going to be working on it as a challenge for the rest of your life, because the other bow wave that's coming through is aging, you know, and aging diseases. And then I would say, you know, another thing that people don't want to think about, but if you take some cancers and make them chronic, and more people die of aging diseases, the cost of healthcare is only going to skyrocket. So you got a lot of things that just naturally are going to make healthcare more expensive than it is today. And meanwhile, you know, I look at immunotherapy and some of the things, it's so amazing where the innovation is going. So everybody's going to pay more. Government people are going to pay more. And we have to work on some of the problems. Break it down like a math guy. Mm. Break a big equation down into four separate equations. Work on them in parallel. Someday we'll be smart enough to put them together again.
Let's go to the other end of the age spectrum. And Catherine Foley talked about the need to get more women involved in STEM and in STEM careers. And Marita Cheng's work in getting girls in robotics. My daughters are 12 and 9.
Yep.
Paul Bassett's called for really overhauling the education system. What should my 12 and 9-year-olds be studying at school now?
Look, You know, my real answer is I don't know. So you're asking me questions where you've got so many people in the room that are smarter than I am. I make maybe two or three observations. One is computer science and life sciences. These are the liberal arts of the 21st century. You know, in other words, everybody in the world is going to have some foundational knowledge. It's going to be like, you know, 100 years ago, learning Latin and math. In the year 2017, computer science and life science are going to be like oxygen. And every student in the world is going to have some foundational knowledge of that, not just for computer programmers, but people that are going to do everything, you know, run locomotives, work in mines. You're going to have to know those two things. And then the other thing I would observe is that what we have to teach people in GE is to be horizontal thinkers, to be, you know, kind of what I call systems thinkers. Universities do a terrible job of teaching people to think horizontally. When you go to work, it's all you do, right? You take a math degree and you turn it into problem solving. You take an engineering degree, you turn it into problem solving. And I'd love to see schools be more horizontal, to be more cross-functional, to get kids working on problems from a very early age. And so I think systems thinking and then treating life sciences and computer sciences as foundational. You know, we ought to be teaching courses to juniors and seniors in high school that basically get them on a path to understanding, you know, the elements of how the body works, what life science is about, what's out there. Because again, it gets back to your previous question. Let's say you're 28 years old in Australia, what's the percentage of GDP in healthcare today? What is it? Let's say it's going to be 15. Let's say by the time she's 40, it's going to be 15%, because almost nothing can stop it. Everybody in this room better have a better grounding on what life science is, how drugs get discovered, things like that, because it's going to be 15, 20% of your GDP.
We saw at the top there about the growth in robotics and artificial intelligence in workplaces. Some people really excited by that, others terrified. Some say it's the robot apocalypse, millions of jobs to be wiped out. Others say humans come through every one of those revolutions and create more jobs and better jobs. Paul Bassett suggested yes, but the replacement jobs won't necessarily be as uniformly distributed around the world as the jobs we lose. Do you have a feeling on this robotics revolution? Should we be wary?
I think it's a great question. You know, again, there's a lot of people that have done more thinking about it than I have. So it's one of these things to think about in the future. I think before we get to the point where everybody in this room is a robot, we have to make everybody in this room more productive. Now, what's the issue in Australia? It's just not a very productive place from an infrastructure standpoint and things like that. So the extent to which we can make every miner, everybody working in the Pilbara, every radiologist working in healthcare, everybody that's you know, kind of working on power solutions and things like that, the extent to which we can make every worker in this room smarter, you're going to have a more productive country, and you're going to create higher wage jobs, and that's step one. Step one is to give every worker modern digital tools for the purpose of making them more productive. We haven't done that yet, guys. We haven't even come close to that yet. So that's step one. The second thing I would say is it used to take 2,000 people and a huge investment to be a productive aircraft engine manufacturer. Now we can do it with 500 people. 500 people. So what that says is Australia could be making jet engines. Australia could be making MR scanners, right? We've basically democratized engineering, design, manufacturing to the point where every country could have the potential of making any product. So I think we're going to go through that phase as well. And then, look, the power of robotics is amazing. The work of artificial intelligence is amazing. The nature of work is going to change. But everybody, you know, one of the things I've learned in my lifetime is always do the easy things first, right? People want to go to like some nth iteration of thought to say, oh my God, what are we going to do? Nobody's going to have a job. Everybody's going to be a robot. There's like 16 steps before we get there. Let's do those well. And then we'll figure out, you know, things as time goes on. But, you know, basic workers, a radiologist today uses 10% of what an MR can create. 10%. So artificial intelligence, machine learning, and radiology, it's not going to replace the radiologists. It's going to give them a chance to use 60% of the computing power instead of 10%. Let's do that first. Something like 30 or 40% of cancer patients walk out the door after diagnosis on the wrong disease protocol. The wrong protocol, 40%. Let's get 100% of cancer patients on the right protocol when they walk out of the hospital after diagnosis, right? When a gas turbine technician fixes a gas turbine, their fix right first time is about 85%. Let's get that to 100%, right? Let's get the availability of an airplane to 100%. That's all I'm saying. Most of it is just kind of, you know, Silicon Valley gibberish, to be honest with you, Adam, is this everybody's going to be a robot. And I say let's make every worker better. I think we have a chance to kind of like see spot run. Let's do the easy things first.
A couple of quick questions and wrapping up before we go on a lot of notes. Autonomous vehicles.
Yeah.
So when you leave here today and you've got to go to your next venue, two cars pull up. There's a hire car with a human driver, and there's an autonomous vehicle, and you and the other Jeff have to get in one vehicle each. It's your call. Which car are you getting in?
I want to do the autonomous just because I'm interested. About 5 years ago, I said, you know, autonomous vehicles, I don't find driving to be that much of a burden, actually. I didn't think I needed to not be able to do it. And then my dad's 90, and I went and rode with him. And I said, okay, listen, I'm all about an autonomous vehicle. You know, that's where we sign up. But I'd get in the autonomous just because I find it to be really a fascinating, I think it's just a fascinating development. It really is. One of the hardest things, Adam, I think for everybody in this room, particularly, it's something that you have to do, particularly in an old line or a core company, which is, what's the difference between a good idea and a bad idea? Not every idea is a good idea. And there's a lot of good ideas that don't make money. There's a tremendous amount of good ideas that don't make money. If you're a venture capitalist, 9 out of 10 ideas fail. And the hardest thing I find is to weave through, like I think autonomous vehicles is a pretty good idea. I can see a lot of ways that it can be used. I think dying on Mars is a bad idea, right? I have no desire to die on Mars, right? And I see all this money, you know, billions of dollars being invested to do rock mining on Jupiter and say, I don't get it, you know? So weaving between all these ideas in a time of major disruption to pick what's a good idea, what's a bad idea, I think it's really hard. I think autonomous vehicles is a good, you know, Uber, good idea. Autonomous vehicles, good idea. Low-cost, flexible robotics, good idea.
I look forward to the day when my driverless car drops me at work, then goes off just Ubering itself out during the day, picks me up, and it's made more money during the day than I have.
Exactly.
I can't wait.
No, but I mean, think about the automotive industry. Think about the disruption. Think about the disruption if you're in the automotive industry between ride-sharing services, autonomous vehicles. You know, it's hard. It's hard, yeah.
You mentioned, you used the phrase, if we were to buy the same book, ... What do you read? Both, you must have business-related stuff. And what's your completely non-business-related? Your biographies type of guy, self-help books, romantic comedy? When you break away from stuff that's really career-aligned.
No romantic comedy, okay. But, you know, I do a mixture. So I read probably 75 books a year. And I'll do a mixture of biographies, love history. I do lots of kind of, murder mystery, you know, like Jack Reacher, you know, Lee Childs. I love those books. And then I've spent a lot of time reading really on the subject of robotics, AI. I'll do a lot of technical reading on science and things like that. Basically a third. This week I go U.S., Australia, Singapore, Singapore, Indonesia, Vietnam, back to the U.S. in about 8 days. I'll read 5 books when I'm traveling and things like that. So it's just a constant thing. And it's really one of the things that I test in GE Leaders, which is, kind of what are you reading? I think there's something about just inherent curiosity that I admire in people. So I'm always trying to test to see how curious our leaders are.
And do you read them off the latest sort of Kindle electronic thing, or do you like
the paper in your fingers? I do everything online except books. I still read books, but I do all my newspapers and magazines and Twitter on the news feed and stuff like that. I do all that online.
This has been a wonderful day. I do want to point out that the organisers from GE have done a fantastic job. What do you want to say in closing to this crowd who've come along to our decoding industry?
I'd say this is real. You know, I don't want mean to sound tutorial or things like that, but if I were an industrial company, I'd make sure my CIO was good. I'd look at the digital assets and digital resources that I had. Most industrial companies 20 years ago outsourced too much IT, and I'd bring a lot of that back. So I'd say shore up your digital resources, learn this really well. And then I think Australia is a place where you can try things. Smart people, constrained market. This ought to be a place where there's lots of experimentation. There's lots of best practices. There's lots of startup capability and things like that. And then I'd say the third thing is your energy problems are solvable. I give you my personal guarantee. These things can be solved, right? It's a little bit of politics. It's a little bit of science. But let's go to work, and we look forward to working with you to solve some of those problems. Thanks.
Lovely closing words. We're about to move out of our afternoon tea. Please, a big round of applause for Jeff Hillman, our special guest.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Thanks, Adam. That's great.
Wonderful.
Thank you.
For more on the latest digital disruptions and innovations in industry, head to GE Reports at gereports.com.au.